So yes, there's innovation, there's great stuff that can be done in the gas sector still to do that, but we also have a lot of the technologies that we need. My view is that, you know, what we're really talking about here is getting them deployed. It's not really about having to make and reinvent wheels. There is some innovation, which is good, but on the other side of the coin, we've got a whole bag full of solutions just waiting to be deployed.
Good day, everyone, and welcome to Cutting Carbon. I'm your host, Jeff Goldmere. I'm joined again by my co-host, Brian Gutnick.
Jeff, good day. Great to be here.
Brian, we've got a very special guest with us today. We have Dr. James Watson. James is the Secretary General of Eurogas, a role he's held since January of 2019. James has an impressive resume before taking the helm at Eurogas. He was the CEO of Solar Power Europe, which is the European Solar Power Industry Association. He holds a PhD in international trade and environmental law from the University of Leeds and is also currently a visiting professor at...
Just call it the Free University of Brussels. That's the English translation.
Great, James. Thank you so very much. Brian, over to you.
Yeah, James, welcome. Glad to have you here today. To get started, why don't you tell us a little bit about what Eurogas is and what its mission is?
Oh, that's a great pleasure to be here, gentlemen. So thanks very much for the invitation. Really looking forward to our conversation today. Yeah, I'm very privileged. I get to be the leader of the European gas industry. And Eurogas is representing all of the major European gas players. We very much focus on natural gas. We're looking at the wholesale market. We're looking at the retail market. So, you know, basically the people you buy your gas off to warm your house, heat your water. And we have the distribution system in Europe, which is one of the largest distribution systems in the world with 2.2 million kilometers. So we've got a lot of pipes underneath us. So yeah, it's a great honor to be the voice of the European gas industry, representing infrastructure, markets, and all the good things that natural gas can bring to Europe.
So with 2.2 million kilometers of pipeline, in effect, that's really a large energy storage system in and of itself, isn't it?
Absolutely. The largest energy storage system that we have in Europe by a considerable distance. I mean, we're talking about a situation where the energy storage potential of the gas grid is over 20 times greater than the existing electricity storage system that we have in Europe today. It's absolutely incomparable to anything else that we have. And we're going to need it. The more renewable, variable renewable electricity that we have, the more we're going to need energy storage to shift loads between summer and winter and between low wind days and high wind days.
So you mentioned, James, we're going to need it, and clearly we will, but we'll also need to decarbonize it. Share your thoughts on how Eurogas is thinking about decarbonization.
Well, we've always seen basically the evolution of the gas system is going to be one which looks at the decarbonization potential of the fuels that we use. And if you look at natural gas has been a great tool for decarbonizing the economies of the world. We're replacing things like coal, we're replacing things like oil, we're replacing high carbon emitters with natural gas today. In fact, we can say 19% CO2 emission reduction in 2019 in the European Union, with natural gas playing a significant role in that. At least one third of that was achieved just by coal to gas switching. But we do know that if we're going to get to net zero, we're also going to have to change the way we look at natural gas. And so in Eurogas, we've become very active and vocal on using carbon capture and storage because we see that there's a possibility to use natural gas in a different way, perhaps as a feedstock to produce hydrogen and capture up to 95% of the CO2 emissions. So you get this great low carbon fuel that can be used by industry to maintain competitiveness. Or alternatively, you can also develop biomethane through biogases. And of course, there is the potentiality of hydrogen, not just blue hydrogen, green hydrogen as well. So we look at all of those options. We say gas is going to be still a very strong part of the future, even in a net zero economy.
So James, you talked about the different production methods, and we've talked about it in previous episodes. But once you've got hydrogen, people are now talking about blending that into the existing gas infrastructure. What's the capability of that infrastructure to handle that? And if you want to go towards net zero, what has to be done to that infrastructure to enable that future?
Well, the gas infrastructure is actually in a pretty good state in Europe and ready to handle hydrogen. Indeed, we've got a history in Europe where we had something called town gas, which was 50% hydrogen and 50% methane. And that was basically powering cities from Dublin to Dresden. Now, when we had natural gas coming from the North Sea, we changed all that relatively quickly. You change the valves, change perhaps some of the compression on some of the pipes. And basically, just by doing that, you were able to go from a half hydrogen, half methane system to a methane system, i.e. natural gas. Well, in our view, it's going to be just as simple to go forward again and go from what is today 100% methane system to change that infrastructure relatively simply into something that can handle blends of up to 20% of hydrogen almost anywhere across Europe. We're using polyethylene pipes. You can go up to 100%. And, you know, a lot of the distribution system in Europe today is new, places like Spain and Greece, and that's built with polyethylene. So there's very little problem for them to use hydrogen. As I say, maybe you have to change the valves. But this isn't, you know, rocket science. We can do it. And right now in Belgium, we're changing from low calorific gas to high calorific gas. A technician will come to your house, he'll check your boiler in 1 hour to see whether or not it's compatible with a different type of gas. That's the kind of thing that we'll see when we blend hydrogen in. No disruption to the consumer, a stable and steady supply of energy that's affordable. It's good stuff.
But what about that next step, right? So 20% will check the box. Great. Love it. But what happens with that ultimate goal of net zero when people want to go beyond 20%?
You're right. You get to 2050, it's a different situation. You're probably going to be having more than 20% hydrogen in your mix, if not possibly up to 100% in some parts of the European Union. We did a study together with DNV, which is a really very competent global consultancy. And they basically said, looking at the cost of the infrastructure, when you go above 20%, don't bother blending 30, 40, 50, 60% in. Go to a dedicated hydrogen system because that's cheaper. That's the cheapest way to get this system moving. Make sure you've got the supply up, of course. And then you're going to have the most affordable way of getting through that energy transition, going from the natural gas system to a system that is basically running on hydrogen.
So, James, you know, you started by talking about this 2.2 million kilometers of pipeline that exists. So overhauling that to make it jump to 100% hydrogen, it sounds expensive. What kind of an investment are we talking about to try to accomplish that?
It's not as expensive as it sounds, because the alternative to going down this route is to do high electrification. And what I'm talking about here is well over 50% electrification of the economy, which ultimately means that you have to more or less electrify heating. Now, to electrify heating, it's a very expensive undertaking, and there's no two ways about that. No matter how you want to dress this up, whether you're an NGO pushing for high levels of electrification, or if you're the European Commission, and they did their own modeling, and we priced it, and it costs 60 trillion euros to achieve net zero by 2030, from 2020 to 2030, 60 trillion euros, with 12 trillion of that being invested in heating and buildings. So, you know, over a third going to heating buildings. However, in our study, if you use hydrogen and biomethane and blends for buildings, you actually save that 12 trillion. And actually, you can really see a huge cost reduction from using a mix between electrification and a hydrogen-based economy, where we saved well over 4 trillion euros. And people are like, hey, James, you keep talking about these huge numbers. You know, I have difficulty imagining what 1 million euros looks like when I see it in a box. What the hell does 4 trillion look like? I live in Belgium. Just across the border, we've got 85 million very industrious guys, the Germans, working really hard, doing their best to make money and put bread on the table. Those 85 million hardworking guys and girls, I should say, are basically able to produce around 4 trillion euros every year through their economic activity. So if you're saving over 4 trillion euros, you're saving the German economy of a year's work. 85 million people working really hard. The economy is strongest, one of the strongest in the world. So when you're talking about 4 trillion, think about Germany, think about those cars, think about all of the great stuff that the Germans do, and that's 1 year of them working. You're saving a year of Germany's work. That's a lot of money.
It is. Boy, that helps a lot to kind of visualize it. Thank you. Talk a little bit about the technology. Are there inventions that are needed to make this bridge in terms of the infrastructure, or is that all technology that exists today?
These are great times, Brian. I mean, there's a certain degree of innovation going on, which you can always be excited about, but there's also a certain amount of technology that we have. So, for example, GE, guys like yourselves, you're developing turbines that can run 100% on hydrogen today. So we are really saying, okay, look, we've got the technologies that we need, so people need to start deploying them ASAP. Then there are probably some technologies where we'd look at and say, like pyrolysis. Today, it's kind of more about in the lab. It's not necessarily there. And for your listeners, again, say pyrolysis is a process which takes natural gas and basically splits the carbon and the hydrogen from the methane, stores the carbon as solid. So it's not a gas. So you kind of have major problems with the storage element because it's a solid. And you end up just then with hydrogen, pure hydrogen. And so, you know, zero carbon, it's all captured. So it's 100%. But today it's in the lab. Now you get that up to scale, that's going to take some time. So yes, there's innovation, there's great stuff that can be done in the gas sector still to do that. but we also have a lot of the technologies that we need. My view is that, you know, what we're really talking about here is getting them deployed. It's not really about having to make and reinvent wheels. There is some innovation, which is good. I think we need that innovation. It's always good to keep the minds alive. But on the other side of the coin, we've got a whole bag full of solutions just waiting to be deployed.
And James, just to pull on that thread a little more, we've talked about the technology and the end use, talked about the technology on the production side, but connecting points A and B, what about the transportation infrastructure, your gas infrastructure? You talked about right above 20%. The study recommendation was just go to a dedicated hydrogen system. Do we have the technology in place, the piping materials, et cetera, to be able just to go do that today if the policy and investment was ready?
The answer is yes. It absolutely is there. I mean, again, if you're looking at the different types of materials we use from the gas infrastructure today, when we're looking at polyethylene, I'm not a salesman for polyethylene, any of the plastic piping is actually really good for hydrogen. You can go up to 100% today. You have to change the valves, but that's a small job. You can do that. You really can. So the infrastructure is really there. Where you've got steel piping, you need to make assessments. You need to make checks. It may well be that you need to do some replacement and some upgrading. Now, that's just a fact and nature of the energy transition. It's not always going to just be plain sailing and easy and we just do this and, you know, A equals B. You're going to have to work to get from A to B. So I think that we shouldn't, you know, say, okay, because we have to change some of the steel pipes to polyethylene ones, this is going to be too expensive. We'll have to sit back. No, the right approach is to say, okay, we have to identify where we need to make the changes and actually then deliver it. We need to get the financing in place to do that and make sure that there is the right kind of public and private financing that can deliver the changes that we need. Now, on one side, we have the European Commission that basically is putting forward a new set of regulations for financing for public money to do infrastructure. And they're saying very clearly they will fund the upgrading of existing natural gas networks to carry hydrogen. On the other side, you've got the private financing, which is being covered by a sustainable financing regulation, where there is much more discussion for what the private financiers can actually support in the next 10 years or so. So for us, we're trying to say, hey, guys, let's get the private financing rules and the public-private financing rules correct so that you actually deliver this transition as cost-effectively as possible.
You're listening to Cutting Carbon. If you're interested in learning more about today's topic, please check out our show notes. And if you like what you hear, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. All right, let's go back to the conversation.
So, James, you talk about the need for financing for the infrastructure, but as well the need for policy to even drive the decarbonization to begin with. How is Eurogas thinking about the policy needs to really drive this deep decarbonization of the gas sector?
Well, we're very progressive in this respect, Brian. I mean, we are a natural gas association. And so what we are saying is that when we're looking at how we go from a 95% natural gaseous fuel market in Europe today to one which is more balanced with natural gas and hydrogen and biomethane, we're saying the best way to do that is give investors certainty and set targets. So what we're saying is give us a 20% GHG, so greenhouse gas reduction target by 2030 from 2018 baseline. This will also cover methane emissions. So you can say we're going to reduce methane emissions and we're going to reduce CO2 emissions from a 2018 baseline to 2030 by 20%. That's already good because if you're really talking about gas replacing heavier polluting materials, then you're really going to see a massive reduction in GHG emissions because of the use of natural gas across Europe today. That will actually incentivize the uptake of hydrogen, incentivize the uptake of biomethane. And if we do this, I think that we'll be able to see a very good return on investment for people who are going, okay, well, I'm going to build an anaerobic digester. I'm going to do an electrolyzer. I'm going to do a CCS plant. Great, great news for you guys because, yep, there's a target that says we need that stuff and we need it now, not tomorrow, but now. And that makes a big difference for investors.
So, James, we've talked about policy and other things, and you talked about kind of if we're smart about electrification, that can save investment. But help us understand what's the magnitude as we think about this energy transition. What's the kind of, let's say, annual investment that's required to do the things we're talking about?
So we've done some modeling, again, with DNV to look at the pathways to get to 2050 for carbon neutrality and comparing the European Commission's preferred approach, which uses a high percentage of electrification, versus our own approach, which looks at a more balanced use of both gaseous fuels and electricity. There's a high degree of electrification, in our opinion, anyway, still within that. And so We think that all you need to do is create a balanced approach. So you incentivize the uptake of renewable and low carbon gases, as well as the uptake of renewable and low carbon electricity. And that balance, that level playing field, will give society what it wants, a secure and stable energy system, not one which is kind of like a one-legged chair, if you like, which is totally dependent on that one leg to stand. We actually have two legs, which is much better for system security. You've got a strong gaseous pillar and you've got a strong electron pillar. And I think that that is really what every policymaker should be thinking about.
Yep, we've had some recent conversations about system resilience, and you've made some comments about seasonal storage. So I think we would be in complete agreement that having a balanced system that doesn't have all your eggs in one basket, as one would say, is an intelligent approach.
Yeah, I think that we have to look very carefully about a future system which is run on variable renewable electricity, because you have to make sure that you're able to deal with some of the challenges that are posed by our seasonality in Europe and in North America. And look, you know, we had snow again in April. In February, we had minus 11. The lowest temperature we've had in Belgium in the last 10 years is minus 14. So you've got to build an electricity system and a gas system that can cope with the minus 14 period. That's not your normal temperature, but that's the temperature you have to build your system to. So for system security, you've got to build to that level. Now, if you're going to try to electrify heat, for example, you're going to have to build five times the capacity that you actually need to run a normal electricity grid, just in case you have a minus 14 to deal with all the heat pumps. That's a hell of a lot of money to spend on a just-in-case basis. So from a point of view in Eurogas, what we're saying is don't build your electricity system five times as big just in case, because you have to do it. Use the existing natural gas network. Use the new fuels that we have, the biomethane, the blue hydrogen, the green hydrogen. Use those, and that will be a much more cost-effective way and a much more system-secure way of handling those weeks, and we'll still get them, where it's minus 10, where it's minus 14. So from my point of view, it's an absolute no-lose investment to continue to invest in gas today.
And James, I like how you talked about it in terms of not a specific technology or fuel, but greenhouse gas emissions. So looking at methane, do coal to methane switching. Again, reminding our listeners, right? Biomethane, it's a fuel that basically has, if you will, a renewable recycled carbon. So it's not a methane that's a traditional fossil methane. So whether it's coming from an anaerobic digester, a landfill, what have you. But I think it sets the perspective, right, that we're not talking about a single technology. It's set a policy framework that sets a goal and let the market, if you will, define what is the right path, what are the right technologies, and the lowest cost path to get that goal without setting a specific path to get there.
Well, that's exactly it. We're seeing that as a level playing field. I mean, why pick winners? Why say we're going to do this hydrogen or that hydrogen? You know, we're going to do green hydrogen, blue hydrogen, or yellow hydrogen, every color of the rainbow hydrogen, and not biomethane, or we're going to do biomethane and not hydrogen. We say no. Set a target and let actually the market still have a role to play, and investors still have a role to play, which they can invest in the technologies they see as best. But that's a mix of biomethane and hydrogen. You know, that's to be seen by the economies of it. We know we have to go down a route. We know we've got options. You set a target. And the technologies which are the most competitive, the fittest, then they are the ones that will survive. Those are the ones which will get us to our goals. It's tough in a way because Eurogas is a market. I say we're markets. We love markets. But with climate change, you cannot just rely on the market to do everything in the way that you want it to do it. Because, you know, every investor is going to say 19 euros a megawatt hour of natural gas in Europe today. Hydrogen's about 85, 90. And the market's going to pick natural gas every time. And that's right, because that's what the market is supposed to do. But that doesn't mean that you meet your climate change objectives. So you have to have a certain degree of interventionism. So Eurogas is kind of accepting that and saying, okay, but then if we're going to have intervention, then we just need to make sure that we do it in the most technology neutral, level playing field approach to make sure that all technologies get a fair chance to deliver on their potential. This is a much better way to get the objective rather than just saying, okay, we're going to give handouts here, handouts there. Way too much interventionism. Let the market still have a role in deciding what technologies we should use.
And it's great. And I think the point that you've made is so telling, that the electricity system today is designed to provide the lowest cost electricity, which means by default, they'll go to lowest source fuel, if you will. Decarbonization isn't free. So to change that trajectory, we need the intervention of policy. We need that shift to realign how, if you will, electricity markets are setting the end goals. Decarbonization costs money, but we have to allow for that extra cost to go forward and accept and move.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's something we've seen. And we understand it from the electricity side because we've had 10 or 15 years of renewable electricity coming on from very small amounts to increasingly large volumes of renewables in Europe. I mean, we're up to about 20% of electricity being produced from variable renewables. So that means wind and solar. And that's, you know, that's come from nowhere in the last 15 years. But it's cost a lot of money, too, because it's been about incentives. And, you know, originally it was called feed-in tariffs, which were basically handouts for producing a megawatt of solar electricity. You received a payment from the government. I think there are much better ways than that. And I can certainly put my old Solar Power Europe hat on and think about that, because we would say, you know, the best way of doing it is tendering, create competition, make competition within the electricity market between the different players. And that's actually, you know, solar and wind could compete against each other. Best deal for society. It's a good way to go about things, Jeff, because it means we have to do this. We have to do the interventions in the wholesale market, both in electricity and gas. But let's try to keep the interventions to a minimum and keep them as efficient as possible on the actual running of the market and also on the effectiveness in the public purse.
Hey, James, I want to go back to, you know, the point of the various types of hydrogen or where the hydrogen comes from. And I totally agree with your point of let the market kind of decide and evolve economically in terms of where that comes from. But doesn't it affect the type of infrastructure build out that you need to make, whether that's maybe more green hydrogen that might be a more distributed, closer to the point of consumption versus maybe a more centralized blue or pink hydrogen from kind of a larger central plants?
The current system we have is quite centralized. We have centralized power production. We have centralized gas systems. You know, we have gas shipped in. They come into LNG ports. They come through pipes. And basically, it's a pretty centralized approach to the way the energy system operates. In the future, it will probably be more decentralized. There will still be centralization, though. And people forget about this. Today, we've got about 12 gigawatts of offshore wind in Europe. To meet our climate change targets, we need 300 gigawatts. You're running 300 gigawatts offshore. To me, that's got to be pretty much centralized because you're going to need landfall and you're going to need, in a way, it's kind of replacing massive power plants by putting them all into the sea. But you're still going to need those cables and they're going to need to come into land. Now, that means that when you look at something like green hydrogen produced from variable renewables like wind, it's going to make a heck of a lot of sense to have green hydrogen also on this sort of, it's probably going to be a transmission system. They're also going to have green hydrogen located close to that because that'll be the most effective way of actually producing green hydrogen. Whereas you might also want green hydrogen electrolyzers also attached to distributed solar in the south of France or in Spain. And so it's difficult to say there'll be one model because I think you're going to be responding to the fact that you're going to have this entirely new system, which is going to be a mix of sort of what I call still centralized offshore, distributed, which is going to be on land, smaller scale, not the 300 gigawatts, but it's going to be, you know, 100 megawatts here, 150 megawatts there, different kind of business, probably attached to the distribution system. So we actually have we're going to have a much more complex system. It's going to need much more digitalization. It's going to need much more monitoring, much more understanding of weather and much more understanding of consumption patterns and consumers. So really, it's going to be a huge role for digitalization. And it's not just going to be on the electricity side. Everyone thinks that digitalization, that's electricity, right? Well, no, it's also going to be definitely on the gas side, because the other thing is that if you're blending, you're going to understand where those molecules are coming from and you're going to have to follow the molecules. Where are they going? Where are they going to be used? Because you definitely don't want to blend if you're in a high temperature industry, you know, using hydrogen for smelting and you don't want to have any variation in the quality of the gas that you're using, and suddenly you get a blend and it changes and you've ruined a batch of steel or whatever it is you're producing. You've got to be careful in how you're doing it. So you need to be able to track the molecules too, and that's digitalization. You need monitors, you need sensors, you need to know where things are going and what they're being used for. So I see it kind of a centralized plus a greater decentralized system, but overall a much more digitalized system, both for gas and electricity, because it's a much more complex system than one we have today. Climate change is going to result in a much more complex, yet perhaps a more user-friendly system, because we'll all be much more engaged with the energy we consume.
And I think, James, the point you've raised, right, in the decentralization, it's not just in the decentralization of, let's say, of the production side, but the end use. If you think about hydrogen being used not just for power, but for home heating, if it's being used as a transportation fuel, whether that's for rail or cars or airplanes, if you're replacing all these other sources of energy with hydrogen, you now have this much larger distribution network where you need to provide this fuel or this energy vector, if you will, to all these other industries, all these other consumers.
Ultimately, as well, there's sort of question about what hydrogen will be used for in the future. And the way that we see it is it's not going to be so different from what natural gas is used for today. And there will definitely be hydrogen used in power. People, you know, think about this sort of, it's going to be all wind and solar and a few batteries. It isn't going to work like that. You're going to need something for the seasonal storage that the others can't cope with. Demand response will play a role too, and I'm not ignorant to this. But the fact of the matter is, when you're talking about the huge amounts of consumption of energy, say in winter, that we get in the US and in Europe, you're going to need a different kind of system. So hydrogen will still be in power. This is absolutely clear. Turbines will still be needed that will need to burn hydrogen. Now, that hydrogen could be blue hydrogen, it could be green hydrogen. The reality is it needs to be hydrogen, it needs to be gas, it needs to be there to balance and stabilize the system. And that to me is, that's a given. Hydrogen heating, more controversial. In Europe, at least, people are questioning whether or not hydrogen will be able to be used to power individual boilers, whether people would feel comfortable with that. I think that they will, because in the end, they're used to burning methane. If you show that it's just as safe to burn hydrogen, they will burn it. And alternatively, there's the district heating that we have in Europe as well, which is where whole districts are heated from a central source, which is usually powered by a CCGT, combined heat and power system. And basically, those big turbines, they will also continue to operate, and they'll burn on hydrogen. Look, I saw one put in the ground last year in Berlin. It was already 30% hydrogen proof. So I see hydrogen in heating. I see hydrogen in power. Of course, hydrogen in transport, that's another conversation. We don't need to get into too much detail on that today. And definitely hydrogen industry. Hydrogen will be a competitive means for industry to get to those high heats that are needed in so many, ceramics and steel and chemicals, you name it. You need those high heats. And so when I look around and I think, okay, what is the future going to look like? We are still going to have a lot of gaseous fuel. It will probably not be as natural gas dominant as it is today. And it will probably be more hydrogen dominant than natural gas dominant in 2050. But it's still gaseous fuels, it's still turbines, it's still going to be providing a backbone of stability to the overall energy system.
Hey, James, could I bring you back to a point I think you made towards the beginning, but I just want to reemphasize it for our audience here, and that's this partnership between hydrogen, which has a tremendous amount of interest and excitement in it, and carbon capture, and the need for both to work together to make this transition. Can you maybe elaborate a little on that? Because with some people, I think while there's a great acceptance of hydrogen, maybe there's a little more public acceptance challenge around carbon capture.
Yeah, I think that's right. The way that we see it in Europe is you've had people in countries like Germany. We always talk about Germany, but it's a good example. They were objecting to having carbon stored underneath their feet, which always makes me smile because there's a huge methane storage underneath Berlin. You and I know the difference between methane and carbon. I think I'd rather have carbon under my feet than methane. But hey, let's not talk about the rationalities of what people see. People were scared. In France, they then said that, we're going to ban it. We're not going to have CO2 storage underground. So there is work to do with public acceptance. The good news is, in a way, if you like, the climate crisis is making people become more accepting of the fact that we need carbon capture and storage. The European Commission, the IEA, the UN, through their IPCC function, have all said we will not meet carbon neutrality in 2050 unless we use carbon capture and storage. So now you've got the big guns of climate change, if you like, coming out and saying, hey, whatever you want to say, guys, we're going to have CCS. So that changes things quite dramatically. Now, they also think in Europe that carbon capture and storage can be done offshore. So you do it under the North Sea. So we had this huge bank of natural gas that we've basically exhausted over the last 30, 40, 50 years. Now we can place there in those empty caverns, if you like, we replace them with CO2. So people are saying, okay, now all we need to do is change some of the gas infrastructure and change it to a CO2 transportation infrastructure. So in Belgium, one of the plans they're currently undertaking is to build a CO2 piping, converting natural gas pipes to carry CO2 from four industrial clusters in the north and south of the country, and then running that up to the Netherlands, up towards the port of Rotterdam, so that it can actually then be shipped over to somewhere like the Northern Lights project in the North Sea, and then you sink the carbon. Completely safe. So this is great news for me because it's actually saying, look, Belgium is saying we're going to invest a whole bunch of money creating a CO2 network based on existing natural gas pipes, which says, you know what? we're going to do CCS. We're going to take it seriously. We're going to do CCS on an industrial scale. We're going to take away CO2 emissions from our industrial heartlands in Antwerp and Ghent and Charleroi and Liège. That's good news because they're being smart, because they're listening to these scientists. You know, Extinction Rebellion and Greta were saying, listen to the science. And then we're saying at the same time, don't do CCS. Well, actually, if you're listening to the science, listen to the IPCC. They had four scenarios to get to climate neutrality in 2050. Three used CCS. The one that didn't use CCS was much, much more expensive. That's not very publicly acceptable. Let's take Extinction Rebellion and Greta's slogan and say, listen to the science. We're going to have to do CCS, ladies and gentlemen. Don't worry, we're not going to store it under your feet, but we are going to store it in the North Sea safely for generations. So don't worry about it. We're going to build at scale. And that then brings me to another point in the UK when we talked about blue hydrogen before for the production of blue hydrogen. Actually, if you've got a huge network like they have in the UK of pipes coming in from Norway and the Netherlands for natural gas, you can actually do what we call landfall sites, where that natural gas comes, you can split using steam methane reformers, you can split the carbon and the hydrogen so that hydrogen just goes on land up to the city gates and is used by the people. And you get the CO2 on shore and basically right on the beach, and then you can put it straight into ships and send it back in the North Sea and sink it. So you basically don't even have to build a whole new hydrogen infrastructure. You build a plant which can split the natural gas, the methane, into its components, and you store the CO2 and you use the hydrogen. The reason we like blue hydrogen in Eurogas is because we see it as a very cost-effective way of building a quick market in hydrogen. Now, the thing about green hydrogen is you have to wait for the variable renewable electricity to be installed. And with the greatest will, they're installing around 20, 30 gigawatts a year. That's just simply not going to give you the market size that you need to get up to having the volume. You've already got a market of about 400 billion cubic meters of natural gas in Europe today. If you're taking part of that and turning it into blue hydrogen, you're going to drive the cost straight down from hydrogen. So what I was saying before, where you've got this sort of 20 euro 90 euro split, that can drop. That can come down to 40 euros. Then it's only a margin. If you've got a CO2 price going onto natural gas, you're going to get closer and closer. You know, we all like green hydrogen. Green hydrogen will become a dominant form of gaseous fuel in the future. But in the short term, to get that market, to get that volume up, we're going to need the CCS with the hydrogen to actually give us volumes of hydrogen quickly.
And so for our listeners who are listening to this and haven't heard yet our episode on both carbon capture and storage from season 2, I would highly recommend you go and listen to those, especially for those who have questions around carbon storage or sequestration. We had a great conversation with a senior geologist from the Global Carbon Capture and Storage Institute who really walked us through the 30 plus year history of storing carbon underground and the rich history and the safety of that. So for folks who have questions or concerns, I recommend you go listen to that episode and maybe help, you know, understand what the science will tell us. So James, this was great. I learned a lot today.
It's been great. Thanks, guys.
Excellent. James, I want to thank you again for joining Brian and I. For all of our listeners, I hope you've enjoyed. Again, I want to thank everyone. This is Cutting Carbon. Thanks for listening. If you want more information about today's episode, check out the resources available in our show notes. I'm your host, Jeff Goldmeer, and this is Cutting Carbon.